Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast, hosted by Renita Ray Davis, licensed clinical social worker, board-approved social work clinical supervisor, and facilitator of the Goddesses of Social Work supervision community. Join us as we travel through the social work journeys told by the Goddesses of Social Work community members, past and present, as they make their way toward clinical licensure.
Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. I'm here today with Nikki Runyon, MSW, LCSW. Nikki Runyon is a Jacksonville, Florida native who obtained her Master of Social Work, MSW, from the University of North Florida, where she was a part of the first inaugural master-level social work cohort. During and after receiving her MSW, Nikki worked within the juvenile justice system with a focus on disrupting the school-to-prison pipeline and reducing recidivism. Nikki shifted to providing clinical services for students ranging from preschool through high school as a school therapist while becoming a licensed clinical social worker. In addition, she provided therapeutic services for individuals and families experiencing trauma and other mental illnesses in outpatient community-based settings. Nikki recently transitioned to academia due to her love of walking alongside future social workers as an adjunct instructor of social work at UNF. Nikki became a full-time faculty member of the Osprey family in August of 2023 and enjoys building community in the classroom and bridging students to the field. While not in the classroom, she continues to learn and implement restorative practices through volunteering with Teen Courts Neighborhood Accountability Boards and the Center for Children's Rights, serving on the Sanctuary of 8th Street's Young Professionals Board, and doing things that fill her cup, being a plant mom and dog mom, spending time with and building community and home projects. Welcome to the show, Nikki.
Thanks, Renita. I'm happy to be here. Yay. Yes.
Nikki, I love that your bio ends with doing things that fill your cup. Why do you think it is so important that social workers be intentional about taking care of their own energy before serving others?
Mm-hmm. Such a good question that I ask students all the time. So thank you for asking me. I think we talk about self-care, and it's easy to talk about it. It's not easy to do it, at least for me. So those things on the bio don't happen as often as I desire them to. But I think having things that ground you, plants are that for me. It's when I'm watering them, talking to them, you know, planting them. It's a space where I can just kind of release and let go. And it's in our code of ethics, right? To care for ourselves and ensure that's happening. Because if I'm not caring for myself, how am I going to walk alongside someone, right? But yeah, just being very real that those things sound really nice in the bio, right? And I do love those things. But they don't always happen. And I have to be intentional about it. And that's where community can come in. You know, checking in on me. Are you doing these things? Can we go to a plant shop together? Things like that. But yeah, caring for yourself, especially if you're telling others to care for yourself, can you do that? Can you do that too?
Absolutely. And you know what, Nikki? I'm a plant mom.
I see.
As evidenced by, and I have several, you know, that I just enjoy looking at myself. One of the things, you know, you said it doesn't happen as often as you would like, but what I know to be true as a plant mom, it's probably happening more often than you're giving yourself credit for, because to keep these babies alive, I know for me in the wintertime, I was taking them in and taking them out, you know, during the frost and all of that. And so it takes a lot of energy. And so I think it's probably happening for you way more. If you're keeping your babies alive, it is probably happening for you way more often than you're actually giving yourself credit for.
Yes. Thanks for saying that. Absolutely. It's a part of just, you know, day to day. I think when you said that, I just thought of when I'm getting frustrated with my plants easily, or if I'm walking with my dog and she's not going as fast as I want, it helps me to check in with myself. Because usually those are the things I enjoy. But if it's aggravating me, then maybe I need to check in a little deeper, right? So I think the things we enjoy in the self-care, if it feels like a burden or too much, like it's really a time to pause and check in and like dive a little deeper. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. It really does. Yeah.
You helped me put that together. Thank you.
Yeah. You know what? I had the pleasure recently of interviewing a social worker who was named best pet store owner in Baldwin County in Alabama. Yeah. And it was one of the first times, and we didn't really dig into it as much as I wanted to. And so I'm just going to take a brief moment here with you to talk about the importance of pets in our lives and, you know, how they help with our self-care. I know we're both plant mamas. I got a fur baby too. Do you mind talking about how being a pet mom helps with your self-care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a dog named Olive. She's a rescue pup. And this is my view on pets, right? So I know it can vary for people, but I think that they are constant and consistent. Olive is out the door when I arrive, wagging her tail. I think they can sense, you know, when you're up and down and don't feel well. And so I think the support I get from Olive, right? Like even Olive, I don't think is knowingly, you know, doing these things, does fill my cup, right? And I think reduces stress. And we know with animal assisted therapy and all these things that are happening, there's actually research around it proving that it is good for our well-being. And there's a lot that can come out of it. That is not my expertise, so I won't speak more on it. But yeah, I think Olive is always there, wagging her tail, there for me. I think just that support too. And if we are feeling tired, burnt out, isolated in the mess and reality of social work, I think sitting with a dog, cat, fish, turtle, fill in the blank can do a lot of wonders.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that your baby is Olive, just to go along with your plant mama vibes. Can't get away from it. Yes.
Yes.
I bet she's gorgeous. I love that. Nikki, I'm going to move on to your social work journey because that's why you're here. And I've been looking forward to hearing about it specifically because you really leaned into the school to prison pipeline. Niche of social work. And so obviously I want to hear, you can start from the beginning, but if you can add how you got involved in that, that would be great.
Yeah. It's always a question of where to begin. So I did not start out pursuing social work in my undergraduate years. And so I went in wanting to be a dietitian for newly diagnosed diabetics. And I did not thrive in chemistry. And when I say I did not thrive, I failed bad. And I was not used to, you know, not, I would freak out if I got an A-. Okay. It wasn't a healthy relationship with school. So I was processing that. And it wasn't that I didn't study. I was studying. I didn't get it. I think, Renita, I got points for putting my name on the exam. Like, that's how bad it was. So I went to the Career Resource Center, took this test, and it uses your strengths to point you in a new direction. And social work was on there, but the university I attended, University of Florida, did not have a social work program. They had something called Family Youth Community Sciences. And I was reading the job descriptions and what people have gone to do with that degree, and I was like, okay, this seems like me, right? And it was a lot of social service provision, teaching, case management, grant writing. Like, there was a lot there. So I changed majors. I'm on this new journey and I love it. I'm like, oh, these classes are fun, right? I actually want to learn these things. And I got focused on adoptions. I have family members that are adopted. It was always a personal interest, I guess you could say, and it turned professional in these classroom settings. So I started volunteering at an adoption agency that transitioned to interning with the child protection team. So then I started learning more about foster care. And then I started learning more about juvenile justice. And then I started working with Project Connect. We get to graduation. I knew I wanted to do a service program post-graduation. So even when I was pursuing dietetics, I knew I wanted to do that. Hence why Family Youth Community Services came up. And I was looking at Peace Corps. It was a lot of individuals in that major went on to do the Peace Corps. But due to medical concerns and different barriers, it just wasn't fitting. So I came across, my mom worked with someone that their son started a program called Mission Year. And my mother was talking to them and Nikki's trying to figure out what's next, you know, that whole conversation. And I'm so appreciative. And they said Mission Year. So I applied. I went to Philly for the interview and it worked out because I was already going to be in Philly. So it's just really, you know, there's these neat connections. And did the interview, met the people, and I was like, yes, this is it. And the program was all about solidarity and justice. Really, the values of social worker show up in it and its values. And I worked in an after-school program. And it was there that I just really was exposed to so many different realities, diverse realities. I'm a firm believer that you need to be up close and personal with those you are serving and advocating for. And I learned a lot about myself and systems. And it was a mom in the after-school program. So I was helping them try to get an IEP. For the daughter, who was one of my students. And she was like, you'd be a good social worker. And I was like, yeah, like I've thought about it, but I'm like, what is social work, right? Like we hear it all the time, but what is it? So then the program ends. I decided I'm going to stay in Chicago. I'm not ready to leave. In my mind, Renita, I'm living there forever and ever and ever. Because I was in the community where I was working, volunteering, all of that. So I do a fellowship and the thought is there, like social work is there and it hasn't really left. So I started doing some research, programs in Chicago. The fellowship year is coming to an end. Like, what am I going to do? So I start looking and I actually started applying at a few schools, hadn't submitted anything, just was like looking and starting. I go home to Jacksonville, Florida from Chicago. Because that's where I ended up in the program. I don't know if I said that. And I am at a wedding in a bathroom talking to this lady. I could not tell you who she is to this day. And we're having some life chats and I'm saying, I think social work. She's like, you know, the University of North Florida starting a program. I said, huh. So I pull it up that night and they had extended the deadline. I had 5 days. To apply. I applied, I got in and moved back home. And that was, it was not an easy decision to leave Chicago and the community there. But I was also excited to come back to where I was from and learn about social work in that context and apply all that I had learned. So I start the program. And at this point, foster care was still the trajectory. So I got an internship in foster care and ended up getting a job. So I could not intern there. And that is what led me to juvenile justice. And that was my first internship. And I was at the detention center. And so we were doing biopsychosocial assessments and referring you to services in hopes of reducing recidivism. So addressing mental health needs versus just incarcerating them. And trying to prove that those services reduce recidivism. And then my next internship was still in juvenile justice. And so the Center for Children's Rights. And that was all about working with schools and trying to mitigate when youth are being arrested and should not be, specifically when they have an IEP or should have an IEP. And there's more that goes on. I don't know if you want me to continue to current day, but I feel like that was a lot. So I'm going to pause.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, we're going to keep continuing, but we will. I love someone recently said, let's put a quarter in the meter there.
Yes.
Let's pause there, like, because some people may not. I obviously don't want to make the assumption that people know what the school to prison mm-hmm. pipeline is. You know, we've been working this field for a long time, so we're very aware of it. So do you mind sharing what that concept is?
Yeah, so I mean, I can mainly talk about it like in a broad standpoint, but also Florida. So really, it's youth are getting arrested in schools. And once that happens, they're on the trajectory to continue to be incarcerated. And so the movement is kind of shifted for discipline. It has now resulted in arrest, right? And disproportionate behavior interventions based on if you are a student of color, right? And how we react to students of color. And oftentimes, so in Florida, we have school resource officers at all schools. And for example, if a student gets in a fight, it is not uncommon for them to get a battery charge, right? And so when that happens, they're now in the system. And there's proof that once you're in the system, you are more likely to be rearrested and continue to be in the system. And so we just have this trend where kids, youth are being arrested with things that could be addressed in other ways, through restorative justice practices, and mitigation versus just arresting them.
And I want to talk about what restorative practice, let's do that. So you know, your focus has been on disrupting the school to prison pipeline. And I heard you say you do that through restorative practices. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about what restorative practices are.
Yeah. So I have to shout out the Center for Children's Rights. I would not know what that is if it wasn't for them. And that is their whole mission. And so it is an indigenous practice, and really the idea, and we could probably talk for 5 hours about restorative justice. So everything I'm saying, school to prison pipeline, restorative justice, it's like the tip of the iceberg. But restorative justice is this idea of connecting, right? And so when I use it in terms of juvenile justice, the best example I can give is say that there is a youth who spray painted a corner store. Okay. And they could get arrested, right? But does that actually repair the harm that was done? No. And so what does it look like to sit in an actual circle? And so a circle is symbolic of connection. And so when you're sitting in a circle, you're all in the circle. And in that situation, you would have the youth, whoever the youth wants to bring. You should have the corner store owner, maybe the folks that can see the corner store that live on that street, right? Maybe the school is involved. Then you might have the legal system involved as well. So they would be present, right? So all the players are at the table and you have conversation. So what happened? What led up to this? What happened after? The goal is not to force apology. The goal is to come up with a solution to repair the harm. And so in that example, say the kid shares that they have nothing to do after school, right? Or maybe their really good friend died on that corner, right? And so actually they were doing something for them, right? Like we start to learn the story, kind of the why behind it. And then we can address those needs. So now the stories come out, we can address the needs. And then maybe the sanctions, right, to repair the harm is that they're going to clean it. And then maybe the store owner's like, hey, you have nothing to do. Do you want to work here? Right. And that's like an ideal example, right? We all know things aren't that that clear all the time. Yeah, it's really gathering. And you can also use restorative justice just to connect and build community. But in the school system, if there's a fight, if a student is skipping all the time, if fill in the blank, like, why don't we sit in a circle and hear each other, right? And have dialogue, and come to a resolution. And you have to want to be there. So it does, you know, and that's where the self-determination comes in, and you got to show up and do it. So the Center for Children's Rights is in so many spaces doing connection circles and really bringing the language of restorative justice to these spaces and systems, and trying to change the culture. And we use it in the classroom. You can be creative with it, but it does stem from Indigenous practice and how to handle conflict and address issues and build community.
Nikki, that is beautiful. And to be able to do that kind of social work, mm-hmm. I'm just imagining that it is so fulfilling. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. You did say that is ideal, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the youth has to be there. And you said you're bringing, and so for lack of, he has to be there. But I'm curious, what about the store owners and the, you know, maybe police officers? What has been their reception to this restorative justice concept? Are they, and kind of putting you on the spot just a little bit. I don't watch the news a lot, but sometimes when I do, I know that Florida is kind of a hot spot right now for a lot of things, and we don't have to get into those. But, you know, being on the street doing this work, talk to us about what's different from what we see on media and what's actually happening within these communities.
So I hear you asking, like, what is the reality of the circle? Yeah. In this,
yeah, especially in that state. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest barriers is all parties showing up. And so there's a lot of programs out there doing or striving to do restorative justice work or restorative work. But a lot of times it's just the individual that committed the crime or has been suspected to have committed the crime. And the other party's not there. And I would challenge that's not true restorative justice, because that's kind of the whole point, is that all players are there. I think a lot of the work being done is education around what is this and what does it actually look like? Because I am just as guilty. I kind of jump on to an idea or something that I love and I don't know the full story of it. Or what does it look like to actually apply this with integrity and efficacy, right? And where it originated from, right? Like, what did it actually look like? And I think we can adapt things, but let's go back to really, what is it supposed to look like? What's the history of it? Where, who started it? What's the context, right? And so I will say the Center for Children's Rights is fighting really hard to educate and bring people in and just show them, right? And so I will say that there's a lot of work to be done. And there are a lot of other places doing it and doing it successfully, and has integrated into systems and spaces that traditionally maybe you would not see those things. I guess Florida here, there's movement, but there's a lot more movement to be done. Does that answer?
Oh, yeah, perfectly. Yeah. But, you know, what I love when you say there's a lot of work to be done, the fact that you guys are introducing, or specifically you, Nikki, are introducing this to the classroom. Mm-hmm. One, as someone who was in the social work classroom previously, I want to hear how that shows up in your classroom settings. And then knowing that you are creating a generation of social workers who this is just going to be in their blood to do, mm-hmm. and know that it's effective. And so then that's how the lot of work that needs to be done gets done, mm-hmm. is through inundating new and upcoming social workers, which, by the way, social work is the fastest growing profession, according to the NASW.
Yes.
One of the fastest growing professions. So there's just going to be a lot of social workers who have now been exposed to restorative justice. And so how does this show up in the classroom setting?
Such a good question. So in a very informal way, and I'll use one of my current classes. So I'm teaching social work practice with organizations and communities. And we sit in a circle and we talk. And it can be that simple. It's not that simple, but it can be. And so if we want to talk about community issues, then we sit in the circle. And usually there's a talking piece and there's some kind of agreement, right? We're going to agree to respect each other. And the talking piece is so it gives everyone the space to talk and we're going to listen. And so if we're talking about something difficult or hard that's happening in the community, let's get in a circle. Let's talk about it. Let's process it. And that's where I can hear different perspectives, right? And different experiences. And building that community in the classroom through a connection circle while learning from each other, self-reflecting, right? And then sometimes coming to a plan of action. Like, all right, y'all, I noticed this pattern. Should we respond to this? Right. And they get to guide. So whoever's in the circle gets to guide. And then encouraging them to think about how can you apply it at your internship or in the field. And really the root is relationship. I mean, if we really want to boil it down, it's relationship. In this really kind of organic, informal way.
And I think what's important too is you're getting away from the textbook, you know, because sometimes I think social workers, especially our younger social workers, and I don't mean by age, just young in the profession, only have access to their own lived experiences. And I know communities is a required class. And so that every single social work student has to go through that class and sit in that circle and create relationship and have and be able to see and hear real life examples of what other people, especially if it's a diverse class and program, are getting to hear their lived experiences versus just reading about it in the book and thinking it doesn't really. They have no responsibility towards it.
And just this idea that we ask clients to share things all the time. Like, what's the issue? What's the need? Tell me your, you know, hardest moment in life, all your trauma, right? That's a lot. And so for us to sit there and practice what we do, and self-reflect, what does that feel like? Like when the pillow, I usually use a pillow in a circle. It's like a heart or a flower-shaped pillow. When the pillow comes to me, is my heart racing? Probably, we're all human, right? Like it can be intimidating. And so also using it as an example to maybe step in the shoes as much as we can of a client when we're filling out a 60-page biopsychosocial about their whole life story, right? And so it's there's so much that comes from it. For sure.
Completely agree. I have the honor of supervising several social workers who are on their clinical journey. And one of the things I talk to them about is get a therapist, one, because the supervision group is not therapy, but I want you to be able to experience what it's like to be on the other side of the table so that we can show up more authentically and empathically for our clients, because we know, you know, one, how hard it was to make that first appointment, two, to keep the second appointment, to show up for the first one, and then to keep the second appointment because, oh, wow, somebody's asking me questions now, not me just asking questions. And what does that experience feel like for you? And so I love that you are doing that in your community's class. We didn't even talk about that. If just for briefly, you're here, you are, you're and the school to prison pipeline doing the work, and which is such important work. And thank you for doing that work. But then you end up in academia. How did that happen, and what has that experience been like for you? And I would also like to say you ended up, like me, in academia without a DSW or PhD, which people
I
think you have
did.
to have, but you are evident, as I am, that that is not necessarily the case. So do you mind sharing that particular part of your social work journey?
Well, gladly share. And good point. I'm glad we're talking about that so people know it's an option. I think we left off in chapter 5 on my, so I can pick back up. So I was interning with the Center for Children's Rights, and then I had graduated. And at the time, it was still pretty new and small. And so being hired on wasn't an option, but I still stay in connection, and I'm trying to wiggle it my way back in because they've grown a lot. But I got a job with the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Grant. So that was at the detention center, my first internship. And I was there for a while, and it was a grant. And the grant somewhat abruptly ended. And so I transitioned to being in schools. So I was doing therapy, and I pursued licensure, which if you had asked me that, I would have told you I'm never getting licensed. And we can come back to that, so I answer your question. But yeah, so I went down that road and got licensed, and I had interns at the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Grant at the detention center. And I loved it. I was like, what are y'all learning? What are you doing? And if they were from UNF, like, how is Dr. Cummings doing? Right? How's Dr. Choi doing? And there was one intern, and we just really connected. We met a few times on a Saturday for coffee for me to walk through how to do APA, how to write a paper, right? Because these are things we aren't born knowing how to do APA, right? And I really enjoyed that. I was playing with the idea of a PhD. So I actually reached out to a professor that I really respect and look up to, and was processing that. And she was like, well, if you're considering it, maybe see if there's an adjunct position. See if you even, if you enjoyed that. And I was like, okay. So I reached out. They needed someone. So I started, I taught one course and I was an adjunct, and then taught two more courses, and was still a school therapist at this time. And then a full-time position opened up, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go for it. And I did. And here we are. So now I'm teaching full-time. And so I left the field in a full-time capacity in August to start teaching here full time, and will still be in the field. There's no way I can't not be in the field. But that's how I got here. And yes, to all those listening, you can teach if you don't have a DSW or PhD. It is possible. We are here to tell you that.
Absolutely possible, and teach well. And I think there's a lot of benefit in clinical social workers teaching, because the PhD is beautiful, but it is a lot of research based, you know, and those who have a lot of, not even a lot, but clinical practice can talk to those who want to do clinical work about what that really, really looks like with real life experiences. And so I think there's a lot of value in clinical social workers also being in the classroom as well.
It's
I do
fun.
Want to ask you about your license, but not for the reason you think.
I'm ready.
as a person who's licensed in multiple states, I'm licensed in 6 states, and I talk to folks about licensure all the time. One of the 2 states often, even though New York is its own thing, it's still, I think, still very doable. But the 2 states I, for years, have been like, oh my goodness, they're own monsters. It's California and Florida. And so you are a licensed clinical social worker in Florida. I actually do have my LCSW in Florida, but it's not through like regular channels. I know you know what I mean. But how was that experience for you? getting the LCSW, starting with the super, because Florida actually does it a lot different than some of the other southern states that I'm licensed in. You can actually take your test before you finish your supervision hours. Whereas for in Alabama, you have to finish your supervision hours before you can even think about sitting for your test. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm just curious, and especially because gratefully I have so many students who listen to the podcast who are out of Florida. Do you mind sharing what that clinical licensure journey was for you?
Yeah. I'll share again. I did not want to get licensed, and MSW me while pursuing my MSW. I was like, I'm doing macro. But come to find out, I learned that in the courtroom, how important it can be to have those letters behind your name, especially for mitigation and mental health recommendations. So that is one of the reasons. I also will say a great supervisor was pursuing licensure and was like, let's do this together. And there was accountability, or else I don't know that I'd be sitting here saying that I'm licensed. And so the process was applying to become a registered clinical social work intern. And to do that, you needed to already have your clinical supervisor identified because you had to share that information. And I was really fortunate to work for an agency, Jewish Family Community Services. So I was with them for a long time. They provide supervision. And so there was actually two people that provide supervision. And so spoke with them. They graciously said yes. To give their time, so much time and mentoring and guidance, and I could rave about them for hours. And so once I identified the supervisor, I applied. And there's a lot that goes in to all of that, the documentations they need. And to be honest, I don't know if I'm just like blocking it out, but it's doable because we're all here, but did that. Got approved and then was at the schools. And so I had a pretty large caseload. And so getting the hours was not necessarily difficult. And did supervision. It took me 3 years though. I like to be honest about that. And that's due to the realities of life, right? So holidays and schools, you aren't working over the summer. So my agency kindly placed me in different settings to keep providing therapy, but it wasn't as many clients, right? And so there was that. I took the test early on and I studied with my supervisor, now friend, and we mapped it out. I scheduled it in like I was still in school, and we bought a program. And I mean, when I tell you it was like, Thursdays from 5 to 7, I'm going to study. We're going to take a practice exam by this time. And it helped to have the end goal in mind. So I scheduled the test. So I knew the time frame. And we took it on the same day. This is funny. We drove together. I got done a little bit before and I had passed. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, wonder if he didn't pass. Like, how are we going to handle this, Nikki? He's having the same internal thoughts, like, okay, I'm going to go out, like, see what her face looks like. And we both just had no expression because we didn't want to, like, you know, be excited if they didn't and vice versa. He had passed too. Thank goodness. So we both passed. And that was pretty early on. Florida, I'm not sure the details, but they just passed where you can't take the test now before you have to be approved to take it after a certain number of supervision hours. And so that has shifted back. I think there's a history of it kind of swinging back and forth. And then I finished up and submitted everything. And if I'm being honest, Renee, it was kind of anticlimactic because you submit all of it and then you get this email that's like, congratulations. I was like, congratulations. So yeah, that's how my licensure journey went about.
I'd love it. And congratulations to both of you passing on the first try.
Thank you. I love that. I know. Thank you.
I can imagine going with someone else and having to wait on them. That would be so nerve-wracking.
Right? We didn't even think twice about it until the moment. And it worked out.
But you know what? It feels really good. That feels really good because you just both knew you had put in the work to pass. And you went in there knowing you were just, this was just a formality. You were going to pass it. And so, yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
But I do love that you talk about having a structured study process. Some people, they feel like they studied a lot, but how structured was it? Was it consistent? You know, it's like going to the gym. You can work out for 3 hours, but you're not really going to get the results that you want if you don't work out maybe 30 minutes three times a week versus working out 3 hours just one day, right? And
Absolutely.
So I like that you put some structure behind that. And one of the things that benefited me when I took my clinical exam was I had a study. There was accountability with, I had a group. It was four or five other women that were studying together. You had your supervisor. I think there's something to be said about having an accountability partner and not just doing that thing on your own. That helps as well. So thank you. And thanks for clarifying that now Florida says, change your supervision hours, and then you can take the test. Let me tell you, when you do it that way, it's a little bit more climatic.
And not to take away, it was definitely like a joyous moment, but I think I don't know what I expected. It just wasn't that.
Email.
And I'll add too, it just came to mind that like we have to think of cost, right? And so I was fortunate enough to split the cost with my supervisor for a study program, but that's not always the case. And so there are a lot of free resources. And so really finding those, doing research around those. Personally, I think half the battle was taking off reality social work Nikki hat and then putting on test social work Nikki hat, and learning how to take the exam. And memory, like, you know, doing all the other, the test prep. But I think if you really dive deep, it's how to take it, how the questions are asked. And so spending some time on that is important.
Absolutely. I always tell people that's really where it's at. It's you know the content. It's learning how to answer those questions. Absolutely. Nikki, I love learning about your social work journey, but I got to move on.
Yes.
One of the reasons, and you kind of even talked about it a little bit already, but one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast was to promote the importance of being in community. Mm-hmm. What communities do you belong to? And maybe there's other social workers that are in those communities. Mm-hmm. And what communities do you feel like you've created? And I know I layer my questions, but what have you learned about yourself being or participating in these communities?
Such good questions. I think my automatic response is where I've worked are my social work communities still. So Jewish Family Community Services, I built some strong, deep connections with some other social workers that have turned friends, right, that I still turn to. My clinical supervisor, I still go to lunch with her. She came and was a guest speaker in my class, right? And so thinking about the community built in those spaces, Center for Children's Rights. I know I could walk in at any point and be received and a part of the community. And now UNF, right? It's building. And I think it's so important because they know the day-to-day of what you're doing. And sometimes that's hard for others to know that are not in social work or not doing the things. And part of the NASW, you know, that's a given. I would like to be more involved. That's somewhere I think I could spend more time building community. And then you would ask, where do I build community? I would say the classroom. That's my new focus and new space. And, you know, it's getting your MSW is hard. It's a lot. And it's a shared experience. And so really creating, I just learned this term, brave spaces. So not, I'm going to move away from safe space because it may not feel safe, but But how do we show up and be brave and vulnerable and authentic and our genuine self? And so I use this model called gracious space to help facilitate that in the classroom and build community in the classroom. Because I think that's where learning happens. If I don't feel like I can share opinions, stories, thoughts, or ask questions to other students as they're sharing, are we really learning? Right. And so trying to build community so that there's intentional, deep reflection and sharing and learning. And then you would ask what I've learned. Is that what I've learned from? I've learned so many things from all of the people I've interacted with. I think from my work communities, who I am as a social worker. So my clinical supervisor would always say, I'm going to share something, but take it and create it for yourself. And I was given the space to be brave and do that and try that and fail so many times, so many mistakes. I've learned too much to even, I don't know that I can put words. I think I'm in debt to so many people that have poured so much into me. And to be you, I think that's like, be you, be you.
I love that so much. And you brought up such a great point, you know, that I hear so many times from social workers, that being in social work community, you get to share your social work experience with other people who know what it's like. Because not being a social worker, sometimes it's hard to communicate, one, because the confidentiality stuff, but it's hard to communicate the experience, which I hope we're doing with the podcast, but it's hard to experience communicate the experience of what it's like to be a social worker. And so being able to be with other social workers who get it is important. Nikki, what is one belief about social work that you started on this journey with that you feel has changed the most?
I think in the beginning, I knew exactly, you know, why I was getting an MSW and what I was going to do and what it was going to look like. And I had mentioned this already. If you had asked me if I was going to be teaching or licensed, I would have probably laughed, like, absolutely not. I despise giving presentations, despised it. And here we are, we're teaching. And so I think the biggest thing is social work is so broad and there's so many directions you can go. And I think plans are necessary and goals are important, right? That's, we need them. But being open to what social work presents, and I mean, it's also hard out there. So I had mentioned the grant ending. That wasn't in my plan, right? But thankfully, social work is so broad. And I was with an agency that was supportive. And I entered the school system, which really makes sense. If you think about, I'm passionate about school to prison pipeline, right? I've been in juvenile justice. This is neat. I get to take these skills and this passion and implement it in this new space. So I think just being open, and I'm laughing at myself because I don't love when this is said to me, but trusting the process. And trying things. And yeah, I think I've been shocked about where I've arrived because I would have never, never told you that. Yeah.
I love that. And I can resonate with that so much. I don't know where this podcast came from. Just out of nowhere. Being able to just be adaptable and pivot, you know, just let social work take you and see where you end up. And it could become a beautiful experience if you allow it to.
It really. You
know, go ahead.
No, I feel like juvenile justice chose me, and I feel that way about social work as well. And I think when I sit with people and have conversations like this, I think we hear that more often than not. Like, it kind of chose me, right? Or kind of when you reflect about where each stepping stone takes you, it's pretty cool.
And especially how when you were recalling your social work journey, you're like, I don't know, I can't tell you the name of that woman. And I don't know who that professor was. Never seen her again in my life. But the fact that these pivotal moments happened for you, that just some random person, and sometimes for me, it wasn't necessarily a random person, but an out of the blue conversation about, oh, have you thought about social work? And no, I haven't. And then here you are creating a beautiful career. And so staying open, I think, is important, especially when it chooses you. So
yeah. Is it okay if I share something
I
else?
cannot wait for you to do so. Yeah, go ahead.
I think another huge lesson, and it falls under the same category of like having a plan, is it's okay to not know everything. I think there was so much fear that I was going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. And while it is our ethical obligation to do no harm, right? I'm going to say the wrong thing. I still say the wrong thing. I probably said the wrong thing at some point on this podcast, right? But I'm so human. I think that's twofold. One of the lessons from my communities, and then also kind of one of the biggest things I've learned or that has shifted or changed. Be human. Honestly, I've built deeper rapport with just my humanness. And it's okay to not know. And that's the beauty of community. So when you have that community, we all have our strengths. Like Renita, you have so many strengths, right? And so now that we have established, you know, a relationship, I'm like, hey, Renita, you know, I can reach out. Or with your work community, if it's one of something you don't feel confident in, reach out, ask for help, bring other people in. And it took me a while. It's like, you know that, but to actually implement it, just like all our clients have strengths, all us social workers have strengths. And so relying on that and celebrating our humanness, this is actually a beautiful thing to just be human.
It really is. And I was talking to a social worker about this. She it's not the same, but it's same energy right now. She was talking about being vulnerable, that in her MSW program, she was taught not to show vulnerability with her clients. And I was like, oh, that's how we build rapport, is through showing our humanness and our vulnerability. Now, obviously, boundaries, right?
Yes.
But how can, I guess I question, how do we help get our clients, help them see that all is possible if we're not showing up as our authentic selves, right? And
so
being
good.
willing to say, you know what, you're right. I even had a social work recently, Nikki, I know now I'm pivoting, who she was saying in supervision that she was talking to a client, and a client called her out on something. Like, when you said that triggered me. And she had to sit back and be like, you know what, you're right. I can see how that would be triggering for you. And then ask him, how would you like for me to bring this up in the future that feels better for you, more safe? I even like the word you said, brave and gracious for you, and was willing, having that willingness to listen to her client in regards to what would make him feel better being in that space with her.
That's so good.
Yeah,
that's so
it really
good.
is. And so I want to transition, it's our last question, but that thought of, I know you do, and I know I do work with social workers who are high achievers. I haven't met a social worker who's not a high achiever, right? And so that's where that whole idea of perfectionism comes in at, and all of that, right? And so, and then even the planning, like I was praising you and your previous supervisor for planning out how you're taking the test and how you thought you're going to plan out your social work career. You know, I work with social workers who are always planning out what their next steps are going to be, even in clinical supervision. When I get done with clinical supervision in June, I'm taking my test in July. But you got to work with the boards and you, me, and all these other people. So you, it may not go the way you expect it to go. But the question I have is, you know, what advice would you give social workers about being resilient when things don't go their way in this profession?
I think what's coming to mind is when you look at whatever your plan is, right? So if my original plan was adoptions and then it transitioned to foster care, juvenile justice, there's a pattern and a trend. And so boiling it down to really why social work, right? And it's relationship and people. And so I think I said this in class the other night, actually, because they're like, I don't know what my passion exactly is, right? And those are great questions. And because you start learning all these things and you're passionate about all of it. But it's like, no, I'm passionate about people. I'm passionate about that relationship. I'm passionate about well-being. I'm passionate about justice, right? And then if I say justice, all that I've done does fall under that, right? And so I think things will be thrown your way. Programs will end. Funding will run out. You will learn something new and it'll pique your interest and you might transition into something wildly different. But there's still commonality, and that is that relationship building. And that I'm not saying don't learn about the population. I'm not saying that, but yeah, I think just being open. And I think there's connections. I mean, we talk micro, meso, macro, but also if I'm working with a child, I'm also working with their guardian. And if I say, nope, only children, is it really only children? No, I have to learn the adult side too. Or grandparents that are taking care of them, right? And so taking it all in, being human, owning that. And yeah, I guess boiling down, like, what truly is it? If I can, across all the things I've done or want to do, can I boil it down to, like, what's driving that? And yeah, for me, that's why I keep saying relationship. It really is that deep relationship. It's so beautiful and so healing, or can be. Yeah.
And that's what social work, I think, is all about, is relationship. Yeah. Right. And it's almost like what you're asking. I'm not saying this is what you're asking, but what I got out of it is, when you think about what you want to do in social work, how do you want to feel? Right. And then go for that. Do that.
That's good.
Do you want to feel fulfilled? Do you want to feel accomplished? What is it you want to feel? And then there's so many things that in social work that are going to get you there.
Yes. Yeah. So many options.
Exactly.
And even social issues, right? There's so many avenues you could take. And so it can be overwhelming, but it's also encouraging. And there's always a job. It's always a job always for the social worker.
Yes. Did I mention the NASW for social workmen said that we are one of the fastest growing professions?
Yes.
It's always a job for social work. You just got to be open and stay open. I love it. Nikki, thank you so much for joining the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. This was an amazing conversation, and I know our audience is going to learn a lot today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I learned a lot, and I'm going to shout you out to the crowd. I mean, you were such a joy through email, and it has just been magnified even more, and I really appreciate what you're doing. It's good stuff.
Thank you. I'm working hard on this thing.
Yeah.
And I'll probably edit this out, but I think that it is important that our stories be told. And I want to do it in a way that honors the profession, because I am in love with the social work profession.
I love that. Thank you, Renita.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. We are glad you were here. If you liked this episode, please come back to hear more stories of the journeys through social work, and please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. See you next time here on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.